Welcome to Housing Matters, the Vancouver Real Estate Show. I'm your host, Stuart McNish, coming to you from the studios at Old Boy Productions, specialist in the development of shows like this one. This week, we take a look at the main drivers behind the increase in real estate prices in major Canadian urban centers. In Vancouver in particular, we examine the role of rising incomes. As wages go up, interestingly, so does the cost of housing. And just as importantly, supply. We don't have enough housing to keep prices down. Our first guest, Ailit Ab-Uroworth of CMHC, says we need to consider both of these factors moving forward if we want to have any chance of solving our affordability crisis. But of course, as housing gets built, there is a feeling that it's all happening beyond our control. Some of that is because most of us don't speak up about neighborhoods that we don't call our home. Our second guest from San Francisco, Sonia Trauss, is a leader in the YIMBY movement, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. She says that as neighborhoods grow, even if you don't live there and you want to see improvement in housing quality, then you need to speak up and say yes, that housing is needed. She says otherwise, council only hears from people who don't want the new kids on the block. She says we all have to take a more proactive approach and add our voices to the yes in that neighborhood and that neighborhood and that one over there too. Because if we don't, then she says nobody listens. But if we do, maybe, just then more housing might get built. But joining me now is Ailit Ab-Uroworth of CMHC. Ailit, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. You were commissioned as an economist to take a look at what are the factors that are driving the increase in the value of real estate in major Canadian urban centers. And of course, the two most important ones are Toronto, but for our purposes, Vancouver. What are the factors that are at play?
Well, as you say, the study was a very long-term study, and we looked at it over multiple years, and maybe we can return to this, but we were basically looking up to say, 2016. And the main reasons that we found for escalating house prices from 2010 to 2016 in Vancouver, well, in all Canadian cities, actually, but the reaction was a bit different. But the main factors are rising incomes, rising population, and then prolonged periods of low interest rates. Now, these factors were all driving demand higher, and then you combine that with a very, well, shall we say, unresponsive supply side on housing, particularly in Vancouver and Toronto.
I found it interesting in reading your report that you mentioned that one of the causes is rising incomes. How does that play out? How is that have such an impact on the value of housing in a market like Vancouver?
Well, I think people want to always live in slightly better housing. So as incomes rise, maybe they want to move from a condo to a single detached. Maybe they want to move from a smaller condo to a larger condo. Maybe they want to move from, I don't know, Coquitlam to the center of Vancouver. So all of these factors are driving up demand. But it's also true that as incomes rise, people want to save a portion of that money. And some of that savings may also feed into the housing market. As incomes rise.
Right. And you pointed out also that businesses tend to locate them in those areas where those higher income earners live because they want to be able to create that easy access to and from work.
Yeah.
These appear to be interesting factors and kind of contrary to the narrative that we had been hearing so much about it being foreign investment that was driving the surge in prices in this marketplace. When you looked at this, what impact did foreign investment have?
Well, to be fair, we have very limited, borderline poor data on foreign investors, and particularly the over time. So StatsCan has now been putting a lot of resources into developing data on foreign investors, foreign buyers, non-resident buyers, to use the technical term. But what they have been concentrating on is having that data across Canada. It's a particular challenge for us in that the data do not go back in time, so we can't look at the history. Now, depending on how you slice and dice the data, the extent of non-resident ownership of the stock of housing in Vancouver, shall we say, is between 5% and 10%. depending on how you define things. There was a recent report that changed the definition, or how you consider a property to have some non-resident influence.
But that could be Canadian non-resident, or foreign non-resident.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that there's a couple living in Vancouver, and one of the spouses is working in the U.S., and so they would be non-resident for tax purposes, but still own the property in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So that's why the use of the word non-resident is a loaded term.
Well, it's a loose term because it's hard to define exactly what it means. Yeah. Well, there had been such a focus on Asian, in particular Chinese investment, that there was this belief that that was what was driving the increase in housing prices. But now they put in the foreign buyer's tax, and it seems to have had a dampening effect on the market.
Yeah, well, a few points on that. The only really reliable, I think, data point on the extent of foreign investors was exactly at the time when that tax was introduced. And I think, if memory serves, it was around 13-14% of the flow of residential purchases were foreign at that time. Mm-hmm. So, and you've alluded to this already, but yes, non-resident buyers had an impact on house prices in Vancouver. But it's just kind of hard to say it's the dominant effect or the principal effect. Like I said, going back to the report, we found that these conventional factors like income, population, interest rates accounted for the vast majority of the increase. We do not have to go beyond that to say what is causing house prices to escalate in Vancouver.
Right. Well, when I think about that income, we see a huge surge in the number of jobs that are coming in the high tech and increasingly in biotech, and they traditionally pay more money.
Yeah.
And so that is going to have an impact on housing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's the same in Toronto. I mean, it may not be the same industries. Toronto has a much larger financial services, but again, it's the same argument. These are very high paying jobs. They're usually in the city centers. These firms like to co-locate to benefit and feed off of each other. And so I think the same phenomenon is at work here in Vancouver.
Right, because they help to create a pool of talent that each of those companies can draw on.
Yeah.
So they keep bringing in these people. They keep pushing up the value of real estate. But you also allude to the fact that supply didn't keep up with demand.
Right. Yeah.
And yet we see construction everywhere. You know, it has been sort of a running joke that virtually every street you drive down in Vancouver, you're going to run into some building that's going up as condo after condo after condo structure is being created. And still it's not enough?
Well, that's what the evidence suggests. The other challenge is that when we talk about the supply responsiveness, we mean quick supply responsiveness. So the fact that there wasn't a lot of supply responsiveness from, say, 2010 to 2016, and now it's catching up. But the issue is that house prices have gone up in the meantime. So what you would normally expect is as house prices go up, there is this reaction from the private sector of building more. But the issue in Vancouver seems to be is that decision to build has been delayed quite a period.
Well, and it's slowed down right at the moment. The figures have just come in that indicate that that whole sector is literally pausing as they're trying to figure out, okay, how's this all going to play itself out? And yet people are still coming to Vancouver. What does that say about being able to create affordable housing?
It's a real challenge, and I think that's a little bit the struggle, is how do you incent or encourage the development industry to carry on building continuously? Because with prices where they are at the moment, there are serious affordability issues here in Vancouver, and so, but it'll take time. But the only long-term solution is more supply.
So you also focused on a couple of different things. One was about the focus on condominium development, but also on single-family dwelling. What's the difference in those two markets when you take a look at it?
Well, what seems to be happening, and this comes back to your earlier point about higher incomes, it's not exactly clear what happened, but as incomes rose, my general feeling is that people would want to move from a condo to a single detached. Mm-hmm. Now, what has happened in Vancouver and in Toronto is that there has been no limited construction of single detached housing. And so that's why the single detached housing really, the prices of those really started to increase. And so those became out of reach. But rather than having an increased supply of single detached, the supply seems to have happened on condos. Mm-hmm. And so people have been moving into condos. I mean, there are struggles there as well, because people want more space, maybe because their families are bigger, and having a two-bedroom condo may not be sufficient for their needs. So that's where there are struggles in that area as well.
In a city like Vancouver, which is landlocked, or the whole area which is landlocked, creating an additional supply of single-family housing becomes a little bit more challenging. Right. So there has to be some pretty innovative thinking that goes
right
to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, digging in a little bit into the data, what we were finding, and I'll make this a little bit too blunt, but what we seem to be seeing in Vancouver is that you have a lot of older single detached housing being torn down and replaced by larger, newer single detached housing.
Right.
And that's not really...
Not more single, but larger.
Yeah. And, you know, with more amenity, you know, more fancy equipment or whatever.
Luxury items, yeah.
And that's not really what we're interested in. I mean, when you have, as you say, a landlocked area, you have to somehow move towards densification, maybe more row houses, townhouses, not necessarily, you know, going sky high, but there are lots of these innovative housing types that could be developed that would increase density significantly.
From your perspective, are we going to continue to see this pressure of not enough supply, increasing demand, and rising prices? No matter what we do, is there any way that we can get out of that cycle?
At the moment, that seems to be the trend. Ultimately, supply, there has to be a supply response in the way that we were discussing, having more density. But this will take time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, going through the whole planning process, but then the actual construction process, this is a multi-year effort to increase supply. So ultimately, supply will be the solution. But in the meantime, it's a very tricky situation.
Well, and then when we talk about that supply, it's creating greater density. And not everybody, you know, falls in behind that as being a good idea. There are some people who go, no. There are a whole bunch of issues that are related to increased density
right
that maybe we don't want to have or invite in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a challenging process moving forward, but one that I think we have to keep a careful eye on so that housing doesn't continue to be out of reach of the average person.
I agree with that, yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming in and sharing this.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. To my next guest, Sonia Trauss. Sonia, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks
welcome
for having me.
Welcome to Vancouver.
Thanks.
You call San Francisco home. What brings you to Vancouver?
The Vancouver Urban Forum this afternoon, right? That's what it's called?
Yeah. And you're going to be presenting. What's the subject of your talk?
Subject of my talk is actually about how pro-housing renters, homeowner allies can get involved in politics and why it's essential.
Why is it essential?
Because our whole system, you know, the reason that we're underproducing housing is that unlike most political decisions where like a sales tax, you know, some politicians put the idea out there and pro and con kind of come and make their case and then the electeds sort of make a decision. When we are deciding about whether to build a new apartment building, we really only ask the people who are by definition going to be against it. We go to the people that live right nearby who already have housing. And we say, what do you think about this? These are the people who are going to experience the harms that are created. I mean, if there are any, but, you know, the perceived harms, the feeling like, oh, there'll be more traffic or my neighborhood will change. But the benefit of that housing accrues to all the future residents and in a small way, really to anybody that's in the market for housing. And our system right now is set up. It's not set up to really like pull all those people in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you're generally pro housing, you can't just sit around and feel like somebody's going to be, bringing your point of view forward. Like, people have to be proactive.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because of course you're talking about the not in my backyard group who go, I'm already here, this is my backyard, I don't want it.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you played a big role in the starting of the YIMBYism, yes, in my backyard movement. As you're explaining this to me, I'm thinking, okay, well, how do you get people who don't live there or even know that they might live there become active and get out and then speak in behalf of the building of rental housing in that area? It seems to be left to those people who are the developer or to representatives. How do you get people then to say, yep, this matters to me, I'm going to get out there and put my voice forward?
Yeah, well, there's a saying, like, there's no better organizer than a bad boss. I mean, one thing is the problem has gotten really bad, so that's helpful. You know, there's people who probably didn't think they would get involved in local politics, kind of looking around, like, what can I do? Things are terrible.
You weren't really expecting it either, were you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was a high school math teacher, and it was just so obvious that in San Francisco, we needed more housing. It's a very popular city. Population is growing. People are having kids. The economy is hot. You know, similar to Vancouver, people are trying to move there, and they just were not building enough housing. It was crazy. So one thing is, yeah, people are starting to get outraged. Another thing actually that does help is really publicizing some of the concerns. You know, housing is at the base of our pyramid of needs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's core. It's like clean water. Do you want clean water? Yes, it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And so people are already kind of they're inclined to think it's good. And then when you hear some of the things that the opponents say about the housing, and sometimes some of the things that opponents say about renters is really prejudiced, you know, like renters, they don't take care of the neighborhood, they don't really belong here, their kids are going to do crimes. That's something that I heard at a public hearing once. It's like insulting. And for better or for worse, we kind of live in like an era of outrage. And we get a lot of people just like that come in because they find out what people are saying on their behalf, you know, that the homeowners will go and say, the whole community agrees with me. You know, these apartments are just going to make our neighborhood a slum. And it's
well, that very thing did happen here around one development.
That people were saying that, or it became a slum?
It'll turn this into a ghetto.
Right, exactly. And it's so, yeah, when people find out that that's like the level of discourse, they get mad. And then it's just a matter of making sure they know where to get mad, who to get mad at.
Okay, so as you point out, the people who live in that neighborhood are the ones who can have a voice because they're there and they go, this is my backyard. How do you then get people who are responsible and invested potential renters to say, okay, I'm going to step up and I'm going to go speak to that issue? Because, you know, we're all trying to live our own lives. And what tends to happen is that these things get left to an advocacy group.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That then is viewed through the lens of, well, you're just advocating for that because that's how you make your paycheck.
Well, as it is now, I mean, I don't know. Like, so you guys have Abundant Housing Vancouver, which is all volunteer run. You know, there is no paycheck there, so no one can say that. But even if there is, I think you have to be pretty cynical to be like, Greenpeace, you just care about the environment because that's how you make your paycheck. You know, I think that the housing act, and this was kind of an open question a few years ago, but there are a lot of housing advocacy groups now all over the U.S. and in Canada, and I think that the elected officials actually have been receptive because they can see that when you bring people to public comment, that's really the most visible thing. Emails and calls are also excellent. But, you know, if you show up to public comment, your city council person will see that you're just a regular person, you know. And
okay, so I think that speaks to the power of the individual rather than the group that we hear time after time after time. So how do we then reach out to people who would be benefactors, because there'll be an increase in supply, to say, come forward, get involved? Because a lot of people go, well, I'm not very good at it, I'm afraid, and so, you know, what's the point?
Yeah, I actually like one of the great things, it's definitely true that a lot of people feel like they're not going to do a good job at public comment. A lot of people think you need a lot of facts and figures. But one thing that I always tell people is to just go and see. You know, don't necessarily plan to talk. But when people go to a city council meeting and they see the level of discourse there, you know, someone might go and think like, oh, I'm not going to be able to make a good speech. But when they see the other speeches, they realize that the bar is low. You know, it's not hard to make a speech. And a lot of times something that a housing opponent says is like so infuriating, you know, or they'll misstate some facts or say something that's just outright not true or something that's insulting, that then the pro-housing person is like motivated and they're like, okay, I'm going to take my 5 minutes or 3 minutes.
Well, I watched one of your videos and I think in it you said, look, even if you don't do a good job
when
you go out, it's better than nothing.
It is better than nothing. They have to hear from you.
And so this is what's important. Now, there are some people who go, okay, so you're going to do all of this. What will be, like, I'm worried about what the downside of it will be. But you say there's a tremendous amount of upside. What is that upside into communities and into the city as a whole?
Well, the first upside is that people get to live where they want to live. You know, whether that's close to work, close to their families, close to some subculture, you know, that is going to help them, like, achieve all of their goals. Mm-hmm. The other upside, actually, for cities is property tax revenue. You know, this is something that definitely gets lost in California. It's incredible. But cities need humans to operate. And then just the general community. Like, I truly believe that density is great. You know, I love living near all kinds of people. It's partially, I'm Jewish, so as a religious minority, I realize that no matter what kind of minority you are, it could be like a religious or racial minority, it could just be that you are very interested in Renaissance string instruments, whatever. If there's a lot of people around, then the likelihood that someone similar to you that shares your interests or your lifestyle being nearby is much higher. And so it just like, it creates the possibility for diversity just like nothing else. And then plus the environmental benefit. Like, we can't keep sprawling.
So, and also there are a number of issues around access to affordable housing for those people who become disenfranchised. As a renter, I'm thinking, okay, well, I got a job and I want to live there and I'm going to get out and I'm going to speak on behalf of development in that community. But by extension, do we also have a responsibility to those people who are disenfranchised, who don't have a place to live, who are struggling to make it through the week or the day?
Yeah, that's absolutely part of it. So one thing I think people don't fully appreciate is how zoning makes affordable housing impossible. When we talk about subsidized housing or affordable housing, I think that what's on the top of people's minds is like, well, if we're going to subsidize housing, you know, if somebody is either making minimum wage or can't work or they're old and they're thinking about the subsidy, they're thinking, well, we have to put money aside from the general fund or, you know, something like that. And you do obviously need subsidy for subsidized housing, but you also need the zoning, the legal framework in place to make it possible in the first place. In both San Francisco and Vancouver, at least 3/4 of the city is zoned for low density housing, like a single family home or a duplex. And by default, what that means is you cannot build subsidized or affordable housing in 3/4 of the city.
Period. Yes.
Period. Because you just can't build an apartment building, and that's that. And there are times and places where local governments will subsidize, like, single-family developments, but not somewhere like Vancouver or San Francisco, because it's just such a high-demand place. You know, they can't afford to basically waste land in that way. And so I think, you know, it's really very unfair because, one, if you qualify for subsidized housing, you're locked out of literally 3/4 of the city. And then, two, we don't have as much affordable housing as we would have otherwise, and we're forcing the affordable housing developers to overpay for land.
Mm-hmm.
So what
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it really it means it's bad on the taxpayers because we have these areas that are like, okay, in this area, you could build high density residential, either subsidized or not. You could build hotel, you could build office. So if you have like a gas station and you're selling it, then maybe you'll sell it to the affordable developer. But that affordable developer has to compete with somebody who's going to build a hotel.
They're going to pay market price.
They're going to pay market.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why it's very, even doubly more important to rezone the low density areas. In San Francisco and California, we're experimenting with rezoning just for affordable housing. And then that way, the affordable housing developer, all they're competing with is some, you know, low density and low revenue use. Mm-hmm. And they can get the land for cheaper, save the taxpayers, you know, or build more housing.
Your overriding message, though, is don't be afraid of density.
Yeah.
When it's coming to your neighborhood,
yeah.
Say yes in my backyard, not no in my backyard.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks Thank you coming. So much. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you for tuning in on Apple Podcasts, thevancouversun.com, and theprovince.com, and of course on the Vancouver Sun's YouTube channel. Please be sure to become a subscriber because you don't want to miss an episode. I also want to acknowledge Arnold Chang, Greta Gibson, and Derek Hayter, without whom this show would not be possible. What a great team. I'm Stuart McNish. Thanks for joining us on Housing Matters, the Vancouver Real Estate Show. See you next time.